begin at 1 Samuel 31 in just a moment. We'll make a connection with what we talked about last week. But in our chronological study Bible, we are at page 335 through 354 this evening. Quite a bit of ground to cover, but with some significant points. And we will try to cover as much of that as we can. I was told after the class last Wednesday evening that it was very difficult to follow me as we went from passage to passage, and that listing the page numbers in the chronological Bible would be helpful. So I've listed them. I will not refer to them, but you will see them on the screen. From time to time I may specify one, but you will see them on the screen as we proceed. Let's make a connection, remembering that the Philistines had mustered and mobilized their armies for a complete onslaught against Israel, and Saul had sought help through a medium to consult with deceased Samuel, and all of that had to be brought about by the power of God. The medium did not have the ability to do that. But the bottom line is that Saul was told that he would suffer defeat, Israel would be defeated, and that Saul himself would die. We'll pick that up tonight as we get into 1 Samuel 31, the last chapter in that book. By the way, we're studying out of this chronological study Bible. If you do not have a copy of it and would like to borrow one, there are copies up here. We'll be happy to loan you one. So if you need one, raise your hand. We'll get one to you. Okay, good. In 1 Samuel 31 and the first few verses there, verse through 6, records Saul's death. The battle is going against Israel. The Philistines are prevailing, and Saul has been struck, mortally wounded, and he calls for his armor bearer to thrust him through with the sword and finish him. The armor bearer is not willing to do that, so Saul falls upon his own sword and dies, and then the armor bearer does the same. So Saul, the king of Israel, at this point is dead. Now the Philistines will come out the next day, and as was customary, they will come to the field of battle, and they being the victors, they will strip the fallen of their valuables or anything that they wish to take. That's not at all uncommon in any battle scene, even today, although it's a much more risky situation today than it was back in Saul's day. It's a very easy matter to booby trap a body, or for that matter, for a wounded warrior to simply lay on a hand grenade that has been charged, and when the individuals come to take care of the dead, set that thing off. That was very common practice in World War II. Many Japanese soldiers did that when they were wounded, and the medics came to assist them. They killed the very men that had come to render aid to them. Well, they didn't have that sort of technology back in Saul's day, and so stripping bodies of their valuables and all of that wasn't that risky, but it was indeed a common practice. So they will take Saul's body, decapitate him, and they will put his body on the wall, nail it to the wall of the city of Bethshan. Bethshan is up about two-thirds of the way from the Dead Sea toward the Sea of Galilee, and it is on the west side of that river. They'll take his armor and apparently back to Philistia, and they will put it in the temples of the Ashtoreth. Now, the Ashtoreth were images of the female consort of Baal. And so to pay homage to her and to give credit to her for their victory, they put Saul's armor in the temple of the Ashtoreth. Now the men of Jabesh-Gilead here is on the other side of the river and slightly, pretty close proximity to Bethshan, but it's over on the east side of the Jordan, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead will retrieve Saul's body and they will bury it in Jabesh. That raises the question, why these men? Why would they have any interest in paying this honor to Saul and recovering his abused corpse?
Were they not from the same tribe?
I'm sorry?
Were they not from the same tribe?
Well, think back to what we looked at in 1 Samuel 11, when Saul has first been anointed as king and not really quite yet accepted by the people. He will rescue the men of Jabesh-Gilead from the Philistines. And by the way, it's interesting. This is a considerable amount of mileage north of Philistia and east, where the Philistines are operating and had been for some time and continue to do so into this lesson tonight. But these men who have been rescued by Saul on a previous occasion will honor him by coming and taking his corpse and giving it a decent burial in Jabesh. Okay? Do you see the page numbers? Okay, good. All right. David is at Ziklag. Remember that the Philistine king Achish had given him the city of Ziklag for his own habitation, his own home, and there with his men, first 400, then 600, were headquartered there. You remember that David, as we noted last week, had tried to join the Philistines, and whether or not he would have actually fought against Israel is a question that the text doesn't answer. I think probably not. And out of Ziklag, he had conducted a number of raids, but never against his own people, even though that's the information that he gave Achish, who thought that David was making himself repulsive to his own Israelite countrymen. But that was not the case at all, and the Philistine warlords are concerned about having David with them and the fact that he might turn against them in battle. He might have, but they would not give him the chance to make that choice. They simply put him on the sideline, and he goes back to the city of Ziklag, and it is there that he will receive this bad news from the Amalekite, who comes to him, and with the claim that he has done what? That he killed Saul. Is that true? No, it's not. Saul had taken his own life, but why would this man tell David that he had killed Saul? What do you suppose he's trying to do? Curry favor. It's well known that Saul had tried to kill David, that Saul was an enemy to David. And so if this man brings news that he had personally killed Saul, then he curries favor with David, he thinks. But with this story, and by the way, as I recall on that reading, he brought a bracelet and the crown that had belonged to Saul and showed them to David, right? You see an implication here? Who came to strip the bodies of the fallen, including Saul's? The Philistines. But this man has his royal bracelet and his crown. So who got there first? Apparently this Amalekite had. And he has these items to present to David to prove that he had actually had some contact with Saul and makes this lying claim that he himself had killed Saul. Well, David, far from exulting in the death of Saul, recognized him as he had previously, through Saul's efforts to kill him, as being God's anointed, and David mourns for Saul, and of course for Jonathan, who was a beloved friend, and he is as well grieved over the defeat of Israel at the hand of the Philistines. So this is bad news from an Amalekite, but it's also some bad news for the Amalekite. Like what? Yeah, David says, you have, in essence, you have signed your own death warrant. You've borne witness out of your own mouth that you killed him, which of course he hadn't. But what does David do with this man, this Amalekite? Has his men executed him. The man thought that he would gain favor. In fact, the text says as much, that he would be given gifts, exalted by David. David, instead, with his kingly authority, has him executed. In your chronological Bible, there is in the text itself, out of 1 Samuel, this song of the bow. And I'm not going to read the entirety of that, except to note the fact that up here, as is recorded in the first part of that song, the beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. Now, how the mighty have fallen, tell it not in Gath. What was Gath? Yeah, one of the major cities of the Philistines. So David is just saying, don't tell this in Gath. Don't let it be an occasion of rejoicing there. Every now and then you hear that expression today when something goes very bad among brethren, the expression, tell it not in Gath, that is, don't go out and spread this all over the country, comes out of this particular incident. But take a look at Psalms 18. It's a rather lengthy psalm, but there are a couple of things of note from it that I'd like to call to our attention. At the very first verse, this psalm of David says, I will love you, O Lord. How's that word Lord spelled? I know it's spelled L-O-R-D, but what else about it? All capitals, which means what? All right, this is out of the Hebrew Yahweh, as we have supplied the vowels, and it is God's personal name, according to Isaiah, the 42nd chapter. And so I will love you, O Lord, that is Jehovah or Yahweh, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my shield, and the horn, that is the strength of my salvation, my stronghold. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. That sound familiar to anybody? Like what, Lee? Yeah, song in our supplementary songbook. We sang this often. And as it continues, David is praising God for his strength and for his deliverance, primarily. And I think the first focus here is on David, who says, God blessed him. I was also blameless before him. I'm at verse 23. And I kept myself from iniquity. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. Now as this 18th Psalm continues, that expression that we read earlier is repeated. Down here at verse 46, the Lord lives, blessed be my rock. Let the Lord of my salvation be exalted. Again, words that we use in this song that are taken directly from Psalms 18. But notice, I'd like to pose a question here. To whom does this psalm apply?
Let me ask it like this, primarily. David's the writer of the psalm. He's praising God for God being his rock, his strength, his deliverer. But who else? This is, I think, an important point in studying the Old Testament. To whom does this, you know, Carol? Well, okay, but I'm thinking of a person. To whom does this apply?
Jesus
besides
Christ.
David?
Jesus Christ.
To Christ. Yeah, exactly. Take a look at Romans 15 and verse 9, and I do not have the page number listed for that from our chronological study, but everybody should have a copy of their own Bible. At Romans, the 15th chapter, when the Apostle Paul was developing the theme that God had brought the Gentiles into covenant relationship with the Jews and blessing all mankind then equally in Christ. And, of course, the Jew, that didn't set too well with some. But that's still what had been promised in the Old Testament. It should not have been a surprise to any Jew when God made promise to Abraham. For example, at Genesis 22 and verse 18, "In thy seed shall only Israel be blessed," right? All the nations of the world, all nations to be blessed in Abraham's seed. Do you think anybody reading that would get the idea that God was going to take this one nation, Israel, that he had formed and blessed for the purpose of bringing the Messiah into the world, was to be the only nation God would bless? Just from reading that promise to Abraham, with which every Jew had to be familiar. "In your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." Isn't very difficult to grasp, is it? Unless the person has a problem with bias. Well, as Paul is trying to drive that home for the benefit of Christians in Rome, notice what he says here at verse 9, "And that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written, for this reason I will confess to you among the Gentiles and sing to your name." Where does that quote come from? Anybody want to take a wild guess and say Psalms 18? Yeah, sure. Notice here it's Psalms 18 and down at verse 49, "Therefore I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles." Does that apply to David? No. But to Christ. "And sing praises to your name." Bob?
Well, there in verse 46, did that phrase, "God of my salvation," be applied specifically to Jesus?
It could be applied to both. God was David's salvation. But who brought the Christ through the cross? "Father, into your hands, what? I commend my spirit," from the cross. Could apply to either. And that's the point that I want to make from this. When we sometimes read these quotations in the New Testament, quoted by New Testament writers, we need to always go back and take a look at the context from which they are drawn. Because there is often a dual application, one immediate in the case of David, and one yet prophetic and to be fulfilled later, as in the Christ. Okay? Just need to keep that in mind as we study. All right, let's notice that David is now anointed as king in Judah. But emphasize that. He is anointed as king in Judah at Hebron, south of Jerusalem. And in this, there's a very generous blessing pronounced by David on the men of Jabesh Gilead.
Would it not have been easy for David to have a very bitter spirit about Saul after all that Saul had done to him, tried to kill him so many times? And would it not have been easy for David to say, well, finally, he's dead, gone, and good riddance? That was never David's attitude. And so in this case, these men who had honored Saul by retrieving his body and giving it a decent burial, David pronounces a blessing upon them from God, and he said from his own hand he would bless these men. In honor of whom? Well, in appreciation for them, but in honor of Saul. That's a pretty big heart, wouldn't you say? Manifest in David. Now then, this son of Saul, Ish-bosheth, becomes king over Israel. Now early on we see this distinction, and it comes into play again after the division of the kingdom in the days of Jeroboam, and where the northern tribes are called Israel, and Judah, of course, is called Judah, northern kingdom, southern kingdom. But early on, these tribes that had been the subject of Saul's reign are referred to as Israel, and David is king of Judah. And, of course, he is from the tribe of Judah. Ish-bosheth will reign, according to the text, 2 years. Now, in parenthesis, I put the name Abner. And the reason for that is that Abner is the man behind the throne at this point. He was to Saul, his commander, I guess you would say his top general, the one who had charge of the troops and in whom Saul trusted. And Abner is the one who sees to it that Ish-bosheth has the throne and is, of course, loyal to him. But I think the point we need to see is that while David is anointed king, Israel is not one just big happy camp at this point. That there is still this following of the house of Saul, with the house of David increasing, but not yet full. And so we have civil war. There are three brothers. Joab, who is David's top commander, and he has two brothers, Abishai and Asahel. In the day of battle, and there's a description here, it's really kind of simplistic, but what it is the gathering of a troop of these soldiers, and Abner out of the house of Saul and Joab out of the house of David, kind of pose this thing as a sort of an arm wrestle. Well, that's really an oversimplification. It is battle unto death between the soldiers of these two groups. And eventually it evolves into a full battle, and the house of David is prevailing. Abner flees. Asahel chases him. How is this man described? Good enough for the Olympics, right? Yeah, fleet is a, what was the?
Gazelle.
Yeah, as a gazelle. Very swift. But you know, if you're going to chase a man who is a proven warrior, you need to be careful, because you might catch him. And Asahel did. Joab keeps trying, or rather, Abner keeps trying to get Asahel, turn aside, give it up, don't keep following me. And Asahel would not listen. So he finally catches Abner, and Abner, with, of all things, the blunt end of his
spear, this blunt-ended shaft, drives it through the body of Asahel, and of course that didn't do him any good. That is Asahel. He falls down dead.
This, of course, doesn't set well with Joab, who is brother to Asahel, or with Abishai, who is the other brother, and that introduces a point to be noted a little bit later. But there's long war, according to chapter 3 and verse 1 of 1 Samuel, long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. If Ish-bosheth reigns only 2 years, and we're going to see that after that, the entire house of Israel joins itself to the house of David, how long would this war likely have lasted? Yeah, not much over 2 years. That's a long war. It is if you're in it. Well, we've seen longer wars. In fact, we've been involved in some in our own time. Much longer. But this is described as long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And we have introduced David's wives. He had, of course, been married earlier to a daughter of Saul, and when David was driven out, he lost that wife, lost that marriage. But according here to chapter 3 and at verse 2 and 3, as David's ascendancy is being described, and as it builds, we see some things that describe it. He is married to a woman named Ahinoam, who is a Jezreelite. And we recall last week that he married Abigail, who was widow of this man Nabal. But then there are four other women that are mentioned here. So David at this point, while he no longer has Michal, Saul's daughter, he has six wives. Polygamy was common and among the kings in Old Testament times. That's an interesting study in and of itself. The law of Moses required any man who would take another wife to treat both wives equally. It was not a lustful self-gratification situation. It was a true marriage under Old Testament law, not in the New Testament and not God's intent at the beginning. I can see how God could do this, imposing all of the moral qualities on a polygamous marriage as on a monogamous one. Why he did it, God never explained. And so I will leave it at that. Now this goes back to Ish-bosheth. His house, his army, has been pretty well defeated, but he makes a big mistake here. Verse 7, 1 Samuel 3, verse 7, and the page number is on the screen, says, Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. So Ish-bosheth said to Abner, why have you gone in to my father's concubine? Whether or not Abner had actually done that, the text doesn't say. But the way it describes the situation, it's not likely. Abner really is upset. Here is the man he has served loyally, served his father before Ish-bosheth. Now he serves Ish-bosheth very faithfully, has seen to it that he inherits his father's throne, and now he's being accused of this wrongdoing. How does that strike him? He's just plain mad, angry with Ish-bosheth, and he tells Ish-bosheth, God do so to me and more also if I do not, and I'm paraphrasing this at this point, do so for David what I've done for you. I will take all of the people of Israel and put them under David, even as God had prophesied that he would take the the kingdom from Saul and give it to David. And Abner is saying, I will see to it that it happens. Did he? Yeah, he did. Okay. So, David's condition. Now, Abner goes to David. He wants a face-to-face with him. And at this point, he has sent a messenger. He's not actually personally speaking with David, but David sends back a message and says, you will not see my face. You'll not have a face-to-face with me unless what? What's the condition? You bring Michal, Saul's daughter, David's wife. At this point, this has been some years, she's married to another man, but Abner will not see David unless he meets David's condition, and that, of course, happens. Abner leads all Israel to submit to David's reign. It's interesting that in the text, while Abner is the one that insists on this, Ishbosheth is the one that takes Michal away from her husband, Paltiel, I think is his name, and sees to it that she is presented to David. So Ishbosheth has apparently knuckled under this. He sees the handwriting on the wall and knows that there is no way to avoid it. So Joab, when he comes, and he brings 20 men with him, they will sit down with David and make this arrangement to bring all of the tribes of Israel under the house of David. But Joab, remember, is brother to Asahel that Abner had killed. Didn't want to, but in self-defense he killed him, but Joab holds it against him. So when Abner leaves to go back to his home, at least temporarily, Joab sends after him and has him brought back for a conference. That's the subterfuge. What does he want to do? He wants to kill Abner. Does he? Yes, he does. He murders Abner. How does that strike David?
Notice.
Yeah, he mourns for Abner. And he disclaims any part in his death. Had nothing to do with it. He puts it squarely upon the shoulders of the sons of Zeruiah. Let's take a look down here at verse 39. A very interesting statement by David, 1 Samuel 3 and 39. He said, I am weak today. And apparently, the sort of weakness that one feels when he's in deep mourning or grief. Said, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me. He wouldn't act the way they acted. David was a man of war and a very formidable warrior, but he was not a murderer. But Joab was and had committed that crime. And so David said, the Lord shall repay the evil doer according to his wickedness. We'll see that down the road a few weeks, but Joab will get his later. All right. In turn, Ishbosheth will be murdered by two men, Baana and I think that's pronounced Rechab. There had been former captains in Saul's army, and they decapitate Ishbosheth and bring the head to David. What do you suppose they're thinking? Same thing that the Amalekite had. Here's a man who has been a rival to David. We kill him. We prove to David that we've done that, and he will reward us. Big, huge mistake. How does David deal with this? Take a look at chapter 4, And let's just read David's words. David speaks to these men, according to verse 9, and goes on to say, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed." This begins to sound like bad news for these two men. Yeah, it sure does. "The one who thought I would give him a reward for his news, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?"
Did he? Yeah, he did. He calls for his men to execute these two to get rid of them. By the way, recall our earlier study back in Numbers 35. What did the Mosaic law call for in the case of murder? The death of the murderer. The blood of the innocent was always redeemed by the blood of the murderer. How many exceptions? Well, he was just young, or he had trouble with his mother when he was little, or he was under economic pressure. Maybe he was having mental angst. What exceptions were provided under the Mosaic law for the death penalty in the case of murder? Zero. None. You shed innocent blood and you die. Period.
A lot of folks today don't really agree with that. In fact, a lot of people in our country don't. It's unfortunate that our country now is so awash in innocent blood that shedding the blood of the guilty would be such a bloodbath. Most folks would have a very hard time enduring it. But that's still the law of the Lord.
There's an
Jimmy, I'm not hearing you.
There's an exception because David should have died according to Nathan the prophet, but he didn't.
Well,
that was an exception.
What the text says, and we'll see over in 2 Samuel 12, David's sin was forgiven.
Yes.
In his confession of it, and of course, Paul quotes from David at Romans 4, verse 1 through 5, as an example of justification by grace through faith. So, okay.
Going on at chapter 5 now, David's reign is acknowledged by Israel as these tribes come to the house of David and pledge their allegiance to him. But what kind of an arrangement? I've got it on the board up there underlined. They make a covenant. Now this is a very common form of covenant among Old Testament peoples and peoples later as well, called a suzerain covenant, in which a king promises to care for a people, to protect them, to provide for them, on what condition? Their loyalty. And that's in essence what you see in what God was promising in Christ. God said, "I will be to them, his people in Christ, I will be to them their God, and they shall be," what? "My people." Suzerain covenant. But covenants, you recall, as we have noted on several occasions, covenants were always made on pain of death for transgression. They were not just simply handshakes and okay if somebody walks away from it. He broke the covenant, no big deal. Yeah, it was a big deal. Covenant breaking carried the death penalty.
That, by the way, is why we needed Christ. All of us were born under a monophoric covenant to our God as our Creator. How many people lived up to God's expectation? All have what? Sin and come short of the glory of God. If man is going to be redeemed from that covenant transgression and his penalty of death, what had to happen? Somebody had to pay the price. So you have a new covenant. And that's why it's new. It's different. Never any other covenant like it before or since in which the death penalty was paid in order to redeem the guilty. Okay? This is not a lesson on covenant, but some principles there we need to be mindful of and remember. David at this point is 30 years of age. You know, this struck me. It's kind of interesting. At what age did Christ begin his personal ministry?
30.
He's 30. Okay. As I said, that David reigned 40 years. 7.5 years in Hebron over Judah, and then 33 years in Jerusalem over all Israel. Now, that's interesting, I think. From the standpoint, if you add those numbers together, you come up with 40 1/2. And according to Jewish count, the half always counts as a whole. So that's 41 years. So what in all likelihood do we have here? Well, we're rounding off numbers. Saul reigned 40. David reigns 40. Solomon reigned 40. It's kind of a neat way to put it and an easy way to remember it. So how long did David live? Well, if he starts reigning when he's 30 and he reigns, quotation mark, roughly 40 years, how long does he live? Well, roughly 70 years. He goes on for a while he is very, very ill with old age, and Solomon will assume the throne. But it's really interesting, out of Psalms 90 and verse 10, another psalmist wrote, "The days of our years are 70 and 10, or as it's put plainly in the New King James, 70 years. If by reason of strength they be 80 years, it is their strength, labor, and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away." How long did David live? Well, he lived up 70 years. If you're 70 years old, I won't ask how many of you are, but if you're 70 years old, you've had your life span. How many here are over 70? You don't need to raise your hand either. But you are on, what shall we say, overtime? And still going well. So, but it's interesting, I think. David lives about 70 years. The days of our years are 70, 70 years. Okay, Jerusalem is taken captive by David. It will become his capital. It's called Zion. The word Zion means fortress. It takes on different meanings or further meanings as the years go by. It will be applied to the city of Jerusalem. It will come to apply to the temple when it is built, and it will come to apply to all of Israel, God's Zion. But here is Jerusalem, Zion, captured from the Jebusites and called the city of David. It will become the capital of the kingdom. And so David increases, and he gives praise and thanksgiving to God. His deliverance, his success, his growth, his increase is attributed not to David himself, but to God. Now, here in chapter 5 and verse 11 and 12 is this very brief statement down at verse 11 and 12 about the king of Tyre. Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees and carpenters and so forth, of course, to build a house for David. Now, what is the significance of that? Other than the fact that this king is doing something very nice for King David. But
There is a political significance here. When a king will come to David and treat him like a king, you have in a very small area, but nonetheless, you have international recognition. Here is another king that recognizes the royalty and the rulership, the sovereignty of David. So Israel is growing, right? Well, David takes more concubines and wives and is blessed with sons and daughters, some of whom eventually will not prove to be such a blessing to him, but looked upon as they are born to the house of David. And the Philistines muster against David at the Valley of Rephaim. Now this little valley is rather small, and it lies between Jerusalem to the north and Bethlehem to the south, fairly small, confined area. And the Philistines will attack twice. They didn't learn the lesson the first time. They attacked twice, and twice defeated roundly and completely. Now this is also to say, what have the Philistines been? Well, they have been a staunch and constant enemy to Israel. What's happening now? They're getting all of the fight taken out of them, aren't they? They are definitely on the downhill. All right, we got a few minutes, and this gets us into some pretty important information. The Ark of God, that is the Ark of the Testimony, it's also called the Ark of the Covenant, and it's part of the tabernacle. Here the Ark is this rather small chest overlaid with gold, and then it was put a copy of the tables of stone, actually, with the Ten Commandments on them. Aaron's rod that budded is put there also, and some of the manna that nourished Israel in the wilderness will be put into this Ark of the Testimony. On either end of this little ark are cherubim, and the mercy seat is on the ark. It is there that the high priest once a year will offer blood, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. For here between the cherubim is the presence of God. So this is a very special thing. And it had been captured by the Philistines. They were cursed for having it and returned it to Israel. It's been placed in the house of Abinadab for some time. When David attempts to bring it to Jerusalem, how do they try to transport it?
Ox cart. You know, wobbly old ox cart. And the oxen stumble, and this man Uzzah does what? He tries to steady it, to touch it. What happens? God strikes him. He dies.
It seems like kind of a small thing for Uzzah to do, and a rather drastic thing for God to do in taking his life. But God had made specific commandments and requirements as to how that ark should be handled. And it would not be breached by anyone without dire consequences. Now, this is the God that we describe as a God of love. He is. A God of mercy. And he is. And because he is a God of love and a God of mercy, he's a patsy. You can treat him however you want, and he'll just be happy that you paid attention to him, right? No, God's word is inviolable. And Uzzah is learning that the hard way. So does David. David's angry that God struck Uzzah. And he asked the question, how can the ark of the Lord, that is the ark of Jehovah, come to me? How are we going to get this thing done if this sort of thing happens? And so the ark is left in the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months. Now Obed-Edom, and we'll see this perhaps later in the Chronicles, is of the tribe of Levi. He's a priest. And the ark is left with him. So news of the blessedness on the house of Obed-Edom comes to David. David's convinced to bring the ark to Jerusalem. Try it again. But guess what? This time he's going to do it God's way. Now, how had God decreed that the ark be moved? Had rings on the corners and gold overlaid poles were used to put through those rings, and the only persons that could bear it were the priests. Right? And that's what David is going to have done this time. Very interesting statement. Let me take us over to page 351 for a second and into First Chronicles. And we'll take a look at verse 11 through 15. Now, this is not recorded. These words are not recorded in 2 Samuel, but we find them here in 1 Chronicles 15, beginning at verse 11. David called for Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, and for the Levites, for Uriel, Asaiah, Joel, Shemaiah, Eliel, and Aminadab. I'm making a mistake here. When you run across a verse like this with all of these tongue-twisting names, you know what you do? You call on somebody else to read it. Okay. David said to them, "You are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites. Sanctify yourselves, you and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord, God of Israel, to the place I have prepared for it. For because you did not do it the first time," that's a bit of an accusation, who's the one that had made arrangements for the transport of the ark? Well, David had. But he says, "The Lord our God broke out against us because we," and there he includes himself, "did not consult him about the proper order." So David's going to do it right this time, and of course it succeeds. I've noted a passage here from Exodus 25, and verse 10 through 33 of how God had specified for the ark to be transported. That's on page 98 of your chronological Bible study. This is interesting, I think. A little bit curious, in fact, that when they begin to move the ark, here on page 344, and at verse 13, "And so it was, when those bearing the ark of the Lord had gone," how far? "Six paces." David is taking no chances, is he? They carry the ark 6 paces and they stop. Nothing adverse has happened. And so great sacrifice is made to God, and then the matter proceeds. This goes on as they enter Jerusalem itself. David is exuberant, dressed apparently only in linen ephod, and dancing and twirling and singing and really exulting in this. And from this comes, remember, Michael now has been restored to him. She scorns him for acting this way. She would imply very foolishly for a king to act, and makes accusations against him. And I ask the question, why? Why is Michael so bitter toward David, her husband? Well, is it resentment over the death of her father and her brothers? Does she resent the fact that following the death of her father, Saul, that David has subsequently enjoyed great ascendancy, has been recognized as king, is growing greatly in his power and recognition by others? Or is it because of her being taken from her husband, Paltiel?
You recall in the passage that describes Michael being taken from this man, from Paltiel,
that he follows along as Abner is taking her away. He follows along weeping. Now, what does that imply about his feelings toward Michal? Loved her. Did not want to lose her. If he was happy with Michal, what likely was her feeling about him? He's probably very happy with this husband. But
do you remember, Bill, from your service days, RHIP rank has its privilege. So David says he wants this woman that was first betrothed to him for his wife. Ish-bosheth is in no position to resist Abner. He's afraid of him.
And David, as king, will have the privilege. And so Abner tells Paltiel, give it up, go home. Do you suppose Rachel might have been unhappy about all of that? Would seem so. So, this is multiple choice. Which of these is right? Well, I would say all of the above. Maybe some other factors as well. I don't know. But let's, David desires to build a house for the Lord. Boy, I'm going to have to really hurry here. Nathan, the prophet, tells David, go ahead. Build a house to the Lord. David said, I have a house. I want to build a house to the Lord. Nathan says, fine, go ahead. God countermands that. Okay, of Nathan. And 1 Chronicles 28, verse 2 and 3, it's spelled out that David was told by God, you will not build my house. You've been a man of war. You shed blood. You will not build my house, but your son will. And so the house of God was to be built by David's son Solomon. Again, from 1 Chronicles 28, at verse 5 through 7. I ask, is there a secondary application of God's promise to David? Bell rang. We'll try to finish this up in about a minute here. Is there a secondary application of David's of God's promise to David? Let's take a look here at 3:45. And to that promise, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you and so forth. One who is of your own body, I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father. He shall be my son. There's again is that suzerain form of covenant. If he commits iniquity, would Solomon commit iniquity? Yeah, he would. He did eventually. Then I will chastise him with the rod of men, but my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, and I removed from before you, or whom I removed from before you, and your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Who does that apply to?
Jesus. Solomon really is established.
Solomon? Are you saying Solomon?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anybody else?
Jesus.
To Jesus. To the Christ. Take a look. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 5. The latter part of that verse, exactly. I will be to him a father. He shall be to me a son. Never said of the angels, the Hebrew writer points out, but the one who is the Christ, this is said of him, and I will be his father. He shall be my son. One other little fact here that we'll point out while I'm taking advantage of your good will to hang in for another few seconds. This statement, I will set up your seed after you who will come from your body. He will reign upon the throne. Psalms 30, 132 and verse 11, this is stated in that psalm, a promise of God to David, that of the seed of your body I will raise up one to sit upon your throne. Where is that quoted in the New Testament? Everybody should know. You've read it how many times? Acts 2 and verse 30. All right. Exactly. Peter quotes this from Psalms 132, verse 11, stated first in 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter, that it is God's promise to David, I will take one of your body and set him on your throne. And that turns out to be the Christ who reigns not by virtue of military conquest, but by what? What's Peter's point? Resurrection from the dead. Okay? All right. We didn't get it all done tonight, but we came awfully close. We were just going to talk about the fact that David accepts all of this and praises God, his Lord, Adonai, his master, the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, and we'll get into 1 Chronicles 9, emphasis on genealogies, and from 1 Chronicles 12, verse 1 through 11, the growth of David's power, of his influence. I kept you a few minutes long tonight. I can't apologize for that because what we're discussing is the Word of God, but I should and do express my appreciation to you for your attention, for hanging in here with me. It's been a real pleasure to be with you, and we look forward to Larry being back next Wednesday night. And I hope you have a good rest of this night and a good day tomorrow.